Folks, you know, I am all about those little pick-me-ups throughout the day. Whether it's tackling work tasks or conquering chores around the house, treating myself is a must. And you know what gets me smiling every time? Japanese snacks. Not only are they bursting with flavor, but their cute packaging and quirky vibes add an extra layer of fun. That is why teaming up with Boxu, a Japanese snack subscription box, has been such an absolute delight, because these are not just your run-of-the-mill grocery store snacks. Each month, Boxu brings you over 20 unique treats that you can normally find only in Japan. Plus, they throw in a nifty guide packed with info about each snack and Japanese culture. Snacking while learning? Are you kidding? It's like this was literally made for me. Oh, and each box ships free from Japan straight to your door. I happen to have a box right here, and let me tell you something. I loved the first box they sent so much, I told our ad people, please make sure that Boxu re-ups, because I gotta get another box of these snacks. First of all, check out this incredible guide here full of beautiful photos. It tells you about all the different snacks. You know, my girlfriend's gluten-free, so we can find one in here that makes sure it works for her dietary restrictions. But she's not here right now, so I'm going to make sure I eat one of the gluten-y ones. Ooh, 20th century pear biscuit. This delicate biscuit is a luxurious blend of 20th century Asian pear, rich cheese, and decadent white chocolate. Oh, it contains wheat, so that means I should eat it. All right, let me find it here. 20th century pear biscuit. Okay, here we go. Found it. 20th century pear biscuit. Cute little packaging. Let me give it a try. Oh my gosh. That is so good. Oh, the pear flavor is really strong. It's like a strong aroma. Next to this crunchy biscuit, the textural contrast is really wonderful. I mean, that is so good. And guess what? There are 19 other different snacks in here for me to try. I love this service so much. And you know why? My favorite thing about it is that they support small family-run businesses in Japan. Boxu has sourced these treats by working with over 245 small makers in Japan, helping out their businesses and helping to preserve their traditions. So if you love Japanese snacks as much as I do, and if you want to try snacks that you literally cannot get anywhere else outside of going to Japan yourself, you have got to try out Boxu. Right now, you can use the code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. Tell them Adam sent you, and now I got to finish these snacks. Oh man, that's really good. I'm glad she's gluten-free so I could eat this one.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
I don't know the truth.
Everyone, welcome to Factually. I'm Adam Conover, and let's talk about music today. Everyone loves music. It's one of the most basic elements of our culture, in fact. I mean, at the dawn of humanity, we would gather around the fire with our buds, crack open a couple deer, and make music together, right? And a few months from now, after the apocalypse comes, we can expect to be doing the same. Music is something that people love to make and something that people love to experience. In fact, for many of us, it's one of the things that makes life worth living. So, as a species, we have a constant demand for it. We always want it. So if that's the case, why is it that it's almost impossible now to make a living at it? We all love music, we all love musicians, we all value musicians more the more talented they are, yet we all know that those who make music aren't rewarded according to their ability or artistic merit. I mean, sure, sometimes a breakthrough song like Old Town Road or Gangnam Style is deservedly rewarded for being the objective masterpiece that it is, but there's a much longer list of incredibly talented musicians who simply aren't able to make a living doing what they're good at. Why is that? Why are we unable as a society to support the people who do what we all love, whose product we can't live without? Well, to understand why, you have to understand that musicians' lives are in fact determined by things that have nothing to do with music. See, despite the fact that music is an ephemeral thing carried by the wind, the truth is that until very recently, musicians in the music industry always, always, always made their money, not by selling the music itself, but by selling physical stuff that contained music in one form or another. In the late 19th and early 20th century, the music industry's biggest moneymaker was sheet music. Songwriters would pump out up to 25,000 new songs a year, which were sold in sheet music form so that people could play them in their own homes on their pianos and sing to entertain each other. The industry actually employed pluggers to play the music in department stores and public squares in order to make the songs a hit, a very early form of mall radio. And when those songs caught on, they could be massive. Sheet music for a sentimental waltz called After the Ball sold over 10 million copies. And that was without the ability to do remixes. That wouldn't come for another 100 years or so. But as technological innovation marched on, the industry adapted. In the early 1900s, they began selling player piano scrolls, which were basically hard-coded instructions you could pop into a player piano to play a song, sort of like a hardware MIDI file. And again, this was used to sell hit songs in physical form, and piano rolls made the ragtime work of musicians like Scott Joplin hyper-popular. But the biggest leap was the development of true physical media. For the first time, instead of storing music as information to be played back on an instrument, new technologies made it possible for the industry to record and sell the sound waves themselves and store them in a physical object that could be mass produced. And this model was incredibly profitable. What started as simple cylinders and shellac or vinyl discs became cassettes and then CDs. Compact discs were cheap to make and expensive to buy, so the margins were incredible. And as music fans rushed to replace their vinyl collections with CDs, the U.S. music industry hit a peak of profitability in 1999, making, get this, $22.4 billion. The money was flowing in, and when you saw glam rockers or rappers, you know, in front of mansions doing songs about how rich they were, that shit was real. The industry was incredibly lucrative. But you all know what happened next. Music went digital, and instead of buying it on $10 pieces of plastic, it became essentially free. In the early 2000s, MP3 sharing made it easier to pirate music than to buy it in a store or even pay for it online, and online music stores barely staunched the bleeding, with the result that industry revenue plummeted to a low of around $7 billion in 2014. Since then, the rise of streaming has bumped that up a bit to over $11 billion, but that is still half of what it was at its peak in 1999. I want to say that again. The music industry has literally shrunk in half in the last 20 years. And not only has the pie gotten smaller, an even smaller amount of that pie is going to the artists who actually make the music. According to one account, Spotify pays a copyright holder on average, I'm going to try to put this into words, they only pay them $0.00318 per stream. That's a fraction, a tiny fraction of a penny. So that track, even if it streams a million times, the artist could only earn $3,180. If they're lucky, some contracts mean that the artists earn even less. But it's not as though everyone in the industry is suffering. Meanwhile, the major record labels have been able to arrange deals such that streaming earns them over $1 million every hour. So the big boys on top in the suits, they're making bank, while the artists who make the actual music starve or have to work second jobs just in order to pursue their art. So where does that leave us? Musicians are still making great music, right? That's never gonna stop. Music is a fundamental human activity. There will always be musicians, and there will always be people who want to hear it. But Because of everything other than music, because of technological progress, predatory capitalism, and our own behavior as the audience shifting to this digital model, that has changed what it means to be a musician. In negative ways, it is harder than ever to make music for a living. So, how do they do it, right? What is it like to be a working musician in today's reality? What do you have to do in order to make a career at this? I have always been intensely curious about that question. And on the show today, I've got the perfect guest to get into it with us. His name is Open Mike Eagle. He's an independent hip hop artist. He's an incredible musician. I'm a personal fan of his music. He's also appeared on Adam Ruins Everything, where he helped explain all the problems in the music industry to us. And he is here on the show today to go into it in an even deeper dive. I know you're going to love this interview. Let's get right to it. Please give it up for Open Mike Eagle, everybody. Hey, Mike, thanks so much for being here.
Of course, man. Thanks for having me.
I've been a fan of yours for such a long time. You were nice enough to be on Adam Ruins Everything, too, last year. Really fun. You're a working musician, correct?
Yeah, most of the time I'm working.
That's how I'd put it. Like, you're not a, forgive me for saying, you're not a massive star. You're not Billie Eilish.
No, I'm not. I'm not. I'm faced with that reality every day. I've had to become quite comfortable with it.
but it's how you make your living. You're not you're not a wannabe. You're not trying to be. You are making your living at music.
Absolutely.
And it's kind of a difficult landscape for me. First of all, the pandemic. How's the pandemic affected your line of work? I can tell you how it's affected comedy.
Well, I'll put it to you this way. For me, personally, I was in the middle of a tour when the country shut down.
Wow.
So I had done 3 weeks of a tour, and like we went through the Northwest. I believe like a few days after we left Washington is when they said they found the first case up there. And so we were kind of like ducking and dodging it and evading it. The merch person on our tour actually got sick near the end of the tour, and we were all thinking, oh my goodness. You know, we're all thinking she's got it, but nobody wants to say it. And
is she on the bus with you?
Yeah, we were in a van.
Yeah.
The first leg ended, and we're home on a break, and the tour is supposed to pick up 3 weeks from that point. Turns out she didn't have COVID, but she had swine flu.
Wait, she had like the plague from 2009 instead?
Yes.
She's just 10 years late?
It was absolutely incredible and hilarious, only because she ended up being okay.
Okay,
but,
thank God.
But we're at home for 3 weeks. The tour is supposed to pick back up again. We're supposed to start in the Midwest and go to the East Coast. And yeah, and then we get word that, I mean, we're all worried because we're all hearing that things are shutting down. And then we finally get the confirmation like, yeah, this thing is postponed and then, you know, ultimately canceled. But this, you know, was something that unfolded over the course of a couple of months from like, oh, we're going to reschedule till September. And then to like, no, this thing is just not happening at all because they had already sold a bunch of tickets. They'd already had a bunch of people's money. So, you know, all these venues were trying to figure out ways to keep the shows happening. And ultimately they had to stop. So this all unfolded over the course of weeks and months. I remember the first big shooter drop in cancellations was South by Southwest being canceled.
Mm.
And this was a year where I had lined up about $12,000 worth of gigs down there.
Shit.
So like that was a huge blow. So like that, and then the second half of the tour being canceled. Like there was a moment in mid March where I just didn't even know what to do. I had gotten to the point where I had scanned my my home for like all the leftover merch I had from like any tour. You know what I mean? Like not the one that I was on, because all that stuff was actually shipped ahead to the place where we were going to start the tour already. But like this box of 12 shirts from this tour, this stack of CDs from this tour, like I put all the stuff together and like organized a sale to sell it all on the internet, you know, over the course of a few days. And like that kind of paid my rent that month.
Wow.
And I also at that point kind of had to divert a lot of energy into my Patreon, because that became really huge for me. And me and this a rapper friend of mine, who's one of my favorite rappers of all time, his name is Serengeti. Me and him, we collaborate under this name Kavanaugh, and we had these songs we were sitting on that we recorded, you know, maybe 2 years ago we had recorded them, and we've been kind of sitting on them. And when Bandcamp first announced it was doing the Friday where they wouldn't take their percentage of sales, we decided to just put that out. But like, we put it out, you know, we called it Quarantine Recordings, and, you know, in our language around putting it out, we were saying like, this is literally like, please buy this to support us, because we are having a hard time. And early on in this, I found that to be extremely valuable. Like, for people like myself who are working musicians, who are fortunate enough to have some sort of fan base already, direct appeals to people for support because things were dire was very effective. So people were like overpaying for things because they knew that the only reason I was selling things was because I lost a bunch of money with tours being canceled, and I didn't have much else I could do in those in between months. So it got really rough early on. Things kind of balanced out going forward. Figured out a few things to help income come in, and I was doing lots of feature verses, which is something that I usually wouldn't do as much. But, you know, not only did I need the money, but I had the time.
Are those and forgive me for not knowing, are those like income? You do a feature verse and you get paid a bit?
Yeah, that's typically how, because this is work for hire, basically.
Yeah.
You know, of course, if it's somebody you know pretty well, you're not charging them. But like,
yeah,
for somebody who just wants Open Mike Eagle on a record, they're going to pay me to be on the record. And yeah, so I didn't know
that was like how the system worked.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's how it's supposed to work. People approach it and execute that in different ways,
of course.
But yeah, that's
man, it's great for great exposure. Like that shit. I'm sure you got plenty of those people.
Well, you know, when I was first starting, absolutely, because when you're first starting, you can't really ask for money, like because they're actually like in many cases either y'all are on the same level that they're doing you a favor, but you know where I am now. At least in being established, people like there's an understanding that them wanting me on the record means that they're going to promote the record and hope that people listen to it because I'm on it.
Yeah.
And with that comes this understanding that they have to pay something.
But let's talk about this. I mean, like, again, as you know, Billie Eilish, but you're a well-known musician. Your shit's reviewed in Pitchfork. Mm-hmm. I was a, you know, fucking indie rock nerd in the mid 2000s. So I still look at Pitchfork. I hate Pitchfork, but I'm like, got a 7.5 from Pitchfork. It's pretty good. Your shit,
It's still something.
I mean, like, you know, there's like a baseline level of, okay, you're a fucking musician. I remember when we talked about having you in our Adam Ruins Music episode, a couple of people in the writer's room were like, oh, I love Open Mikey. Oh, he's great. Yeah, let's get him on the show. Like people know your work, right? Mm-hmm. We don't often think of musicians whose work we like as being folks who are having trouble paying their rent.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Or who we need to support, like just for like, hey, I want to support them, but they're probably doing okay. Right. And I think that's such a contrast with, like, you know, I talked about it in the intro, like the difference between the 90s, right? Mm-hmm. Where, like, you know, because of the CD boom, like it was just a completely different industry. And
absolutely,
like today, like I can't think of an industry that's gone through a bigger change than that, at least certainly not in media, where it's like shrunk and changed. And like the way the artists make their money has gotten so different and strange. I wonder how does it look to you?
I mean, that is certainly that's a reality that we all have to contend with, that the revenue pot has shrunken drastically. Yeah. And then, like you said, it's about the way that people are consuming music now. And it's weird how we got there, because we went from, you know, CDs being $10 a unit, and you sold if you sold a million of those, that was awesome. If you sold 2,000 of those out of your car trunk, that's still pretty great. You know,
yeah, like there's good margin on each of the individual ones. Like you're when you're selling plastic, it's for $10. You're making a good profit on every single sale.
And it scales down well. That was the thing. It was easier to be independent then because the way that people consume music made a revenue pool that scaled well with you as an individual. Like I said, if you sold 5,000, 10,000 of something, that was great. That was great. But now if you sell, I mean, it's hard to even say sell. If you get the equivalent of 5,000 album streams, it is a far different revenue level. Because the streaming revenue just doesn't scale down at all.
Yeah.
It just doesn't. Like if you're streaming in the millions all the time, or, you know, half billions, then it's great. If you're streaming in the tens, thousands, you know, hundred thousands, it's not good at all.
I mean, how does that look for you? Like, I mean, you don't got to tell me how much money you make off of streaming, but like, I assume people are streaming your stuff. What does that look like? Like, are you literally just, hey, that's kind of not even a piece of your income pie, or
it's a hard to quantify piece of my income pie. And that was part of the reason why I started my own label too, is because the way that you get paid when you work with labels, the way, like, it's impossible to depend on or calculate royalties when you're waiting on a label, because they're waiting on distributors to pay them. Then, you know, they're taking however long their accounting takes. You're supposed to maybe get paid quarterly, you know, and then there's all these expenses that they paid, and some of them you understand and some of them you don't. Like, on the label side, like as an artist working through a label, it's impossible. But, you know, me putting out my records myself, so now I have a direct relationship with the distributors. So now I get money monthly, but it's still hard to quantify how much is going to be. And really, in the marketplace, I've only put out at this point one EP under my own label, which is, you know, of course, not a lot of catalog to chart revenue from either. So, you know, in a couple of months, I'm going to put out my first like actual album under my own label. And at that point, you know, the streaming revenue I get from month to month should go up, but I'm not exactly sure how much.
And that album, by the way, people can pre-order that album right now.
Yeah. There was a vinyl pre-order that sold out, a special edition vinyl. And then
I was going to buy it. Oh, it was on my to-do list. And now I've missed out.
I'm a hard salesman on the internet, man. When there's something to move, I'm on there trying to move it. And honestly, that brings me to another means of creating income is selling merch.
Yeah.
I've done 5 or 6 merch designs over the course of the pandemic, and everything in limited quantities. And, you know, the sales model, the business model is that you announce these things are available. There's only 200 of them. And because they're limited, people want them and they go. And like, that's another way that I've had to. I had to put a lot of energy into that too, to pay bills while there's no shows.
Yeah. I mean, that pre-order was like, I got a variant album cover. It's like more expensive than a normal LP, I assume. Right.
Yes.
And it's like a limited run of 1,000, and it's like on your Instagram, hey, go get them right now. And, I mean, and the album isn't going to come out for a couple months. So that's like a way of like, was like smoothing out the income for you and like making sure you're able to get some before it actually goes out.
Right. I mean, you know, I'm the way that the vinyl manufacturing works is that, you know, the distributor does the manufacturing. So it's not so much to make, like, it wasn't so much to make sure that, cause I make sure they were covered, cause they were covered either way. But it is like it's literally a way to make sure that I get some income up front from the energy around releasing a new project.
Yeah.
You know, it's like set a thing aside, make it special. And then for people who are really into me and want to have that special thing, then like that is a pool of income for me.
Yeah.
Because other than that, then it's just depending on the streaming. It's depending on the traditional retail model of vinyl. And all that's still going to happen. But like I said, all of that's really hard to quantify.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, when you look at the industry overall, like, because I could, you know, if I wanted to have a really, you know, optimistic, positive interview with you, I could say, oh, man, like Mike's doing it. You know, like he's making his living doing this. He's really smart and he's got all these ways to make income. And you got your Bandcamp, you got your Patreon, right? Like you can live tour. Oh, well, not right now. But hey, we can find all these other revenue streams. Right. And say, oh, wow, that's really great. Like anybody can do that right now. Right. On the other hand, I look at it and I say, hold on a second. You're really talented. You've had some success, right? Mm-hmm. People love your work. And yet, to get by, you have to sort of like be doing all these hustles constantly.
Hustle. Yes. Right? Hustle is the word.
And what I always think about that is like, hey, hustling's great, but not everybody can hustle. Like, you clearly have a keen business mind, and not all musicians do. And I don't think that knowing how to hustle in that specific way should necessarily be like a prerequisite to being a musician who we all get to enjoy and gets to make a living.
I absolutely agree. Because, you know, and it's also about like I have the luxury of having a team. I have a manager. You know, I have agents. I have, you know, like I people who can try to make stuff happen for me. And even on a more basic level than that, people I can put my head together with and try to come up with some ways to manage this. And, you know, there's a lot of people, there's a lot of really, really talented artists in the world who don't have any of that.
Yeah.
And I don't know how they do this right now. Like, I think about if somebody's independent right now and they're just starting out.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I don't know if it's possible. Like, I don't know what you do. Like, unless you're one of those people who's like really good at controlling your own narrative on the internet and kind of creating some buzz that way, whether it's through videos or Instagram, or like if you have that skill or that instinct, then you can do it. You can navigate it. But if you don't, like, what if all you have is great musical talent?
Yeah.
And you don't have anything else. I do not know how you do this right now. I have no idea.
Do you mean under the pandemic, or do you mean in the industry the way it is right now?
You know, I want to say both. I want to say that this was already a problem before the pandemic. And now, like, the before the pandemic, it was difficult. Now, I think with the pandemic, it's impossible.
Yeah.
I do not know what to do. So I have my label. I put out a project from an artist, Video Dave, who's a collaborator with mine.
Yeah.
We put it out in March, and, you know, we spent money promoting it and on PR and in a video. And, you know, he's a person who's been making music his whole life. But like, I really wanted him to have a proper album release and a campaign. And it was impossible.
Wow.
It was absolutely impossible. I mean, part of it is that because earlier you asked me about the difference in revenue and the difference in how you make money and if that's kind of unprecedented or if that's happening in other fields. I think it's happening in journalism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think they've experienced a great shift in how it is that they make money. And I bring that up right now to say specifically, the pandemic had a giant effect on how indie music is covered.
Hmm.
A lot of sites who would be covering indie stuff let a lot of staff go and didn't have a lot of budget to hire freelancers to cover stuff. So with those sites tightening their belts, they weren't taking chances on things that weren't sure to bring eyeballs to the site. You know, since there was no budget for freelancers, these writers had no incentive to try to convince editors to take a chance on something.
Yeah.
So, you know, we released it, and I used every piece of wisdom that I've had from my experiences and how you make a project go. But because he was new and didn't have an established fan base or an established catalog, it was almost like it just didn't happen.
Like, it's like if you put out your new album or your new video and a place like Pitchfork will do a little news brief because they've already covered you.
Yes.
And they're like, oh, yeah, open mic. He's a guy who we cover. He's got a new project. Make our little post. It goes up. But someone new, it's like, how do you convince that outlet to even write the little blurb? Especially when, I mean, if so much has changed so fast, like I remember there was like MySpace and there were like music blogs and like, yes, that was different.
Yeah. That was when my career started, that's all you could hope for was to be on a blog, to be on, yeah, Pigeons and Planes, Two Dope Boys, and you know, all of these independent sites that ultimately became part of Complex or became part of, you know, Condé Nast or whatever. That is another thing that doesn't exist anymore. The editorial power that those blogs used to have now belongs to Spotify.
Yeah.
Now belongs to Apple. Like, the people who make the big playlists inside of those companies have complete editorial power right now.
Yeah.
Like, they're the gatekeepers.
That really concerns me. Like, I listen to this Apple podcast, Apple Music podcast, not podcast, playlist, called Beatstrumentals. And it's like, it sounds like that YouTube video, that YouTube stream that was lo-fi. Lo-fi beats to study and relax to. It's like that. And I'm like, so I put that on while I write. And look, I'm not feeling cool, like I'm listening to some cool new music. I just have some nice relaxed beats in the background. But then I heard a track and I was like, oh, let me, who is this? And I Googled the person and I find their Twitter account, and their Twitter account is like, oh, thank you so much, Apple, for putting me on the playlist. Yeah. Oh my God, this is huge. Cause they're just someone in their bedroom who's made, yeah, like a beat that made its way on Apple Music somehow. That was like the biggest thing for them. And I'm like, this can't even be making them any money, because I know what Apple Music pays and not that many people are listening to this. This is not one of the big playlists. They're not on Rap Life, you know?
Right. But it's still a big deal, though, because,
yeah,
you know, it's equivalent, if not better than being on the front page of you know, Rap Radar in 2011, you know, like it's a big deal, like the exposure. Like, because what happens is it's like this feedback loop where if they put you on a playlist that has 45,000 listeners, then, you know, you have a song that's going to be increasing, and also your monthly listeners is going to start increasing too. And all of this, like, you know, and then you start getting on people's daily mixes and getting on people's release radars when you put out a project. And it's like, really? Spotify and Apple, like they hold all the keys right now.
And how do they decide who goes on those playlists? I mean, I imagine some of it's algorithm, but some of it's human curated too, right?
Yes. There are. I know there used to be way more humans that made those decisions in curation. Now I think it is a little bit more algorithm based. But I'll say this too. If you talk to a distributor, that's what they spend most of their time doing.
Wow.
Is trying to convince Spotify and Apple to put their products on prominent playlists.
Just these huge, but see, there's such a big difference between trying to call the writer, you know, a Pitchfork or whatever, or whatever blog, which is like employs human beings. It's a small publication. They do a music festival. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like part of your world versus like you got to call somebody at Apple,
yep,
and try to get them to give a shit about you, a $2 trillion company.
And they only have a few people on staff whose job it is to do that. And could you imagine all of the, yeah, inquiries that they're getting constantly?
And that's such a tiny piece of their business. They don't, like, if their curation's a little bit better, it doesn't make a huge difference. They're just doing that to, like, hey, Leah, let's have a little curation on there. Like,
I don't know. I honestly do think that curation is a big part of their their audience attachment in terms of people using their products. I do think that that is important for them too.
But they give a shit less than an actual, yeah, music writer does.
True.
You know what,
true,
I mean?
Yeah, 100%.
They work at Apple.
Yeah, like, it's not. Yeah, they don't like, oh, I really love this song. You know what I mean? Like, it's not that.
Yeah.
You're right. It's not.
I cut you off earlier, though. I mean, what else do you think about these guys?
About who?
I'm sorry. What kind of impact does that have on you that you have to, like, you know, a lot of your fate is like controlled by these giant companies.
I mean, all I can do is put myself in the best position to continue to exist. Seriously.
Well, I hope you continue to exist.
Well, as a business entity, as a musician, as a public figure, and what that means, knowing where all these levers lie and who holds them, it's like, okay, I have to keep my distributor happy. I have to give them assets to help them put my products in the best position, and they're working hard trying to talk to the what are they called? Digital service provider. I don't know, DSPs is what they're called. Apple and Spotify. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
So they're talking to the stores, trying to get, because it's all the digital version now of what it used to be when you go to Amoeba. Like, you go to Amoeba and there's the giant CD racks and you're in the section you want to have and you're walking down the giant aisle, and at the end of the aisle, there's this end cap, right?
Yeah.
And 10 years ago, this end cap was the most important thing in music.
Right. Like,
if you were a distributor, you wanted the Killing Joker Face's new LP on that end cap. You were on the phone with John from Amoeba every week to make sure that record was on that end cap. It's the digital version of that. Like, these distributors talking to people at Spotify, talking to people at Apple. If you ever go to Apple Music and you see, like, there's that little banner that's like a picture of the artist and the name of the album, and it kind of scrolls by, like,
yeah,
that's the golden ticket.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's how you know that, you know, that store has a great relationship with that artist by means of their distributor, by means of their label, because the labels are big in this too. Like,
yeah,
that's really, like, that's the part I can't directly speak to, but I can tell that it's huge because they're taking up all the oxygen in the room. You know what I mean? Like, my independent distributor is talking to these people, but they're spending most of their time talking to Warner, talking to Universal, and talking to Sony, you know?
But does that feel at all like, you know, completely divorced from what you're doing as a musician? I mean, I saw this guy, a musician named Julian Villard, wonderful singer, mm-hmm. songwriter, piano guy, and I saw him do a show, and he introduced a song by saying, he was like, so I don't like normally perform this song, it was on one of my old albums, but then for some reason it was added to a Spotify playlist, or the algorithm liked it, and I don't know why, and it suddenly got like hundreds of thousands of listens, this like random song off an old album, so it's like my most popular song now, and I don't know why it happened, so anyway, I guess I'll play it for you. And I was like, wow. that's so weird to like have that, to have a song get big, like, okay, this is my most popular song, and I literally don't know why it happened.
Yeah, I mean, that is weird, but I imagine that used to happen when there wasn't digital too. I imagine people would put an album out and a song would catch on that wasn't a single. You know, it was just a deep cut that people started liking and they didn't know why. You know what I mean? I do think the playlist thing does exacerbate it, because you don't know why. But, and I think in some ways you never knew why. You know what I mean? So I don't know. That's not so bad feeling, I don't think.
How do you feel about those companies? I mean, a lot of people, you know, have this idea, like we do about all these big tech companies now, where like, oh, Apple and Spotify, like, they're bad for music. Like, I feel guilty for using them. Like, how do you feel about that as a music producer? Do you think people shouldn't use them and should like all be pre-ordering vinyl from you instead? Or I mean, obviously you think they should do that.
I mean, but I approach it with some level of understanding and some level of practicality. Because we didn't get here by accident, you know. We got here because hard drives got, you know, consumer hard drives became such that you could put lots of music on them.
Yeah.
And now we all walk around with a hard drive in our pocket. And so once consumer storage became such that you could hold on to albums in a convenient way, that meant that at some point people were going to stop buying them.
Yeah.
And so the industry went from $10 a unit to the void of downloading. Downloading was just a chaotic, insane, depressing void of just like, you don't know how much money to put into marketing something. You could almost depend on the biggest projects that were coming out to be leaked by somebody who worked at a warehouse and that would destroy the value of these things. And there was, you know, there was so little money coming in. It was about artists trying to convince people to please buy a thing that everybody has for free.
Yeah.
It was really rough. And so we landed at streaming as a way to monetize the fact that everybody was downloading albums anyway. So like that Spotify and Apple represent the reality of consumption. The reality of consumption is not $10 a unit, and it's just not gonna be. You know what I mean? Like, and if it's just like, you know, if you really like a movie, you might buy the Criterion Collection DVD because then it means something to you, and there's packaging that makes it like more valuable. Where, you know, the album itself is just information.
Yeah,
you know, it is recorded information that you're paying to own or interface with in some way. And streaming is the practical reality of now. You know, ownership is not a thing. We're not going to be able to own things that we can download going forward. It's just not going to happen. You know what I mean? Like we're subscribing to the news now even, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's just not, it's ownership is not how this is going to work, you know? So I think that streaming, is not the worst way, because I saw the worst way. The worst way was trying to get everybody to buy it. Nobody would, and everybody would download it for free anyway.
Really? Because I always sort of felt that like when it went from, my assumption was that when it went from like, you know, iTunes downloading, when people would buy it, you know, buy those to streaming, that like revenue went down even further. But those were actually the worst days to you, the iPod years. We had CD years, iPod years, streaming years. And you think iPod was worse than streaming?
Was iPod worse than streaming? I think iPod was a stopgap thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think iPod was a transitional thing.
Music Store, that world.
Yeah. I that was great while it was around. But you were asking people to pay for something oftentimes they already had.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like you were paying as a way to show support. And I think like, yes, that support is important, but I don't think that as an industry, we want to depend on appealing to people's emotions that way, like as a means of survival. It's like we have to figure out a way to do it practically in a way that makes sense for what the piece of information is actually worth in the marketplace, you know?
Man, I have so many more questions for you about this. We have to take a break, and but we're going to come back right on this note.
Okay.
We'll be right back with more Open Mic Eagle.
Folks, today's sponsor is one I cannot recommend highly enough, Delete Me. As a Factually listener, you know how much I value online privacy. Well, Delete Me has been an indispensable tool for me for many years. I've been using them long before they even started advertising on this show. This day and age, it is shockingly simple for data brokers to peddle your personal information without your consent. These data brokers may be selling your name, phone number, and home address, and you might never even know it's happening. Trying to locate and remove all this data yourself can feel like an impossible task, but that is where Delete Me shines. Their team of experts tirelessly scour the web to track down and wipe out your personal data. In just 7 days, you will receive a detailed report of their findings. And believe it or not, a whopping 41% of Americans are vulnerable to online harassment, from doxing to scams and even identity theft. In some cases, having your info online can turn cyber stalking into good old-fashioned in-person stalking. Protect yourself yourself from these threats with Delete Me. So if you're like me and you value your personal privacy, you want to make sure that your identifying personal details are not floating around the internet where anybody can buy them, well, you can get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/Adam and use promo code Adam at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/Adam, code Adam. I wholeheartedly recommend this service. Check out Delete Me. Today's show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Our lives are super demanding these days. I know that I constantly catch myself wishing for extra hours in the day. But here's the thing. The problem isn't as simple as lack of time. It's that we often have trouble prioritizing what's actually important to us, whether that's seeing friends, talking to family, or even kicking back with a good book. This is one of the ways that therapy can be so valuable. Working with a professional can help you figure out your priorities and make time for the stuff that really matters. And therapy isn't just for big trauma. We can all use a little help, whether it's learning to deal with stress, setting boundaries, or just getting stuff off your chest. So if you're thinking about giving therapy a shot, you might check out BetterHelp. They say it's all online, super flexible, and fits right into your busy life. You just answer a few questions, and they say that they will hook you up with a licensed therapist. Plus, you can switch therapists at any time, no extra charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/factually today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/factually. Hey, everybody, I know we're in the ad break, but we're doing something a little bit different today. Today, I'm going to tell you about an amazing group of people who did not pay us anything to be a part of the show. We just think they do amazing work, and we wanted you to know about them. You might remember back in 2018, those heart-wrenching stories of families torn apart by Border Patrol, refugee children being pulled away from their parents who were in turn deported to their home countries. It was devastating then, and it's just as devastating now, with hundreds of families still not reunited after all these years. You know, we discuss so many problems on Factually, but I firmly believe that there is always something that can be done about those problems. And recently, I came across an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice. Since 2018, they have successfully brought together over 100 families torn apart by Trump's zero-tolerance policy. But reuniting those families is just the beginning. Al Otro Lado continues to support each family with legal aid, housing, and counseling to help heal and get back on their feet. I mean, can you imagine the agony of having your child ripped from your arms, unsure of when you'll see them again? We cannot allow such family separations to continue. So if you're like me and believe that all families belong together, then join me in supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today. You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website at alotrolado.org/volunteer. Thank you so much.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, so let's just keep talking about this. The technological changes that the music industry has been to just in my lifetime have been nuts. Like, I think it's bananas that now I've got nostalgia for the MP3 years. You know what I mean? That, like, I had my CD collection in high school, then went to MP3s, and like now we're on streaming, and I still buy, I buy vinyl and I buy physical, and that's like when I really like a record, like I buy that. And so I feel like we're still kind of have the best of physical media if we want to. You can still get the best sleeve, you can still own the thing and have it in your house. That's really nice. But I think it's so funny that, like, you know, I like I actually have, I regret us missing out on like the best of torrent sites now. Like, there's a couple of music torrent sites that are still up, and I use them every once in a while. And the reason I use them is because there's a couple where they actually have a better catalog than you can get on Spotify. Like, they've got, like, you want to get a, you know, you want to get a Charles Mingus album, they've got every album and they've got every release of it, and you can get it with the bonus tracks, you can get the remaster, you can get a vinyl rip, you can get, like, it's the, like, the Library of Alexandria. And now music piracy's gone from everybody's doing it and it's ruining the industry to like, nah, now there's just 5,000 nerds around the world who are exhaustively cataloging all music, and we should just let them do it because...
Absolutely, we should. Absolutely, we should.
Because we need access to that sometimes.
I mean, there's another conversation to be had. And I, you know, and I, it hits me in a very direct... I have so many feelings about it because I come from underground rap music, and underground rap music I come from was mostly distributed by like white label singles. It wasn't proliferated. It was never successful, but these songs, this music was really important to me and important to this community that I come from. And this music largely doesn't exist in streaming.
Mm.
Because those labels were small labels that aren't around anymore, and they never got bought by bigger distributors. And, you know, like there's all these rights issues, and, you know, and a lot of it is an artist kind of just like deciding, okay, it's been long enough. Let me upload this and hope nobody cares and I don't get sued. But like, it's a lot of that. And I think that there need to be efforts taken to like Library of Congress all music, like all of it, like it needs to be preserved, because as much as I appreciate Spotify and Apple for dealing with the consumption of music in a practical way, music's existence shouldn't depend on that solely.
Yeah.
Like, and that's where it is right now. We're like, you get the sense that if something isn't on Spotify, it doesn't exist, because there is so much there. But there's a lot of stuff that gets missed. There's a lot of songs that are missing. There's, you know, there's artists' entire catalogs that aren't on there.
Yeah.
And I think that some efforts for preservation, because these, you know, like music recordings, and a lot of times can be more like culturally important than retail would have you believe.
Yeah. Yeah. So much of media has that problem. Video games has that problem really hardcore now too, where it's like, if something, it's really hard to preserve old media, and you sort of end up looking to the pirates as being the people who are like uploading the version that, you know, you can at least get if you're a student, or if you want to go back and hear something, like, cause it's not always available commercially.
Right.
Yeah. And there, it's like, it's sort of lost in the internet somewhere, and you like need these volunteers who we've been treating like pirates for the last 20 years to like uphold the history.
I mean, and it's like there just has to be some way where, like, okay, copyright law is important, understandably, but there's got to be some wiggle room for preservation. Like, copyright law in a lot of ways really destroyed the hip hop that I grew up with, like, just really destroyed it. Like,
how so?
Because once sampling laws were instituted and became, you know, violatable in the ways that people could get sued and cease and desist, and, you know, so much money. And once that became a viable thing that would happen in a lot of cases, and producers became scared of it, there's just a lot of classic rap albums that could never be made today. They just couldn't be made.
Yeah.
Or they could be made, but it would be cost prohibitive, because each one of these copyright holders has to name their price, and then it gets into, you know, the millions. And then at that point, it's not even worth making, because it's never going to make that back.
Yeah.
And I think that, like I said, copyright is important, but it's not the only important thing. And I want there to be some sort of way where legally or culturally we give some credence or some sort of energy to the other important things, not just the law part.
I mean, there was that movement in like the mid 2000s, like the Creative Commons movement, to like have like copyleft and these ways of copywriting things where, you know, okay, I'll let people use it for such and such a purpose, for like sampling, right? Like, I still own the music, but anybody can sample it, kind of. But it never really caught on. It was like a sort of like digital punk kind of thing to do for a little while.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that stuff doesn't make people money. I mean, if you're a copyright holder, your best bet right now is to have somebody to represent your library and be out there like hoping somebody samples it.
So you can sue them and you can make money off of it.
Well, not even so you can sue them, just so like you can get the clearance money.
Yeah.
You know, like that's a hustle. That's a hustle.
Yeah.
That a lot of people are on, and there's a lot of reissue labels who buy particular artists' music just for that reason, just so they can control the samples. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And I'm saying, like, I get all of that, you know, I get all of that. If I was a jazz musician in the 70s and, you know, and I watched my contemporaries' music get rediscovered or sometimes stolen from, or, and like, I totally get like wanting to protect yourself. And to me, I think it's even more about if there's some way to designate certain songs as okay retroactively. But like I said, it's just about preservation and just about making sure that things aren't disappeared. Cause that's the problem with digital. Things can be disappeared.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you said, if it comes off of Spotify or Apple, it's like it doesn't exist. But like, okay, so with piracy, I always felt, I remember at the time, I pirated a ton of music. I feel bad now.
Me too. I feel shitty. I feel really bad now. I had to realize, Adam, that I'm partly responsible for the destruction of my own genre.
How so?
Because when downloading first started, some of the fastest and most vicious and relentless downloaders were people like me who were in underground rap music.
Yeah.
And we would jump on Napster, SoulSeek, LimeWire, whatever, every day, just looking and downloading.
Because you're trying to gather music to hear, to feed your own creativity. Like, you're going to be voracious for that shit.
But that music was the most vulnerable to piracy. Like if you were Metallica, yeah, you were worried because your income was being threatened. It might mess with your quality of life, but you were still going to sell hundreds of thousands of albums.
Yeah.
If you were the Juggernauts and you came out with an album in 2000 or 99, that label needed you to sell 10,000 of those for any of this to work. And us downloading made sure that didn't happen.
Yeah.
Like if they needed my $10.
Yeah.
And I didn't give it to them.
Cause you're the audience.
Yes.
You're like literally one of the few people who likes the music or who knows
exactly.
The music.
I'm the market.
And the whole market is on Napster, yes. BitTorrent, whatever it was.
So we killed it. Like we did that, you know, like we watched Rap City and Yo MTV Raps, and we're complaining about how like only commercial rap music is on TV and is being marketed. But the reason why that was is because those people were still paying money for music, people who enjoyed that stuff.
Yeah.
We stopped cold. and that destroyed the genre.
But also, I mean, let me give you a little credit here, because like we're about the same age. I remember those years. I was like, I don't have $10. I don't have $20. Like, that's how I felt as a college student, or like right out of college during the years where I had the least amount of money. And now that doesn't account for the fact that in the years before that, I bought like 200 CDs when I was in high school. Right. Like, I still have them. They're in my garage. But like, you know, at the same time, you're like, hey, what am I supposed to do? Mm-hmm. I can get this stuff for free. I wouldn't hear this music otherwise. I'm hearing so much more music than I could. And, you know, I'm a young person who knows how to use the internet. Mm-hmm. Like, am I really going to go out and spend music? Like, there's a spend money on this when, you know, my finances are limited, right? And there is that piece of it. Like, also the people that you're talking about who were buying those Metallica CDs, well, they were older, mm-hmm. and they had jobs.
Yeah. I mean, but, you know, we chose not to pay. And that is in some ways reflective of what I was saying. Like, okay, the hard drive is big enough now. The internet is fast enough now.
Yeah.
These goods no longer become commercially viable. And
yeah.
Us as music fans, we were the first wave of it. You know what I mean? It's just technology meeting the market, and that's just kind of what happened. So, you know, where I say that, I mean, the reason I can say so, I say so confidently that we just, that, you know, people in my community destroyed the market is because now me being on the other side of it, I have just an intimate knowledge with like, oh, right. You know what I mean? Like, that's why that label's not around anymore, because they needed my $10 and they needed all of my buddies' 10 bucks. Like, they did so much better when one of us would buy it and then dub a tape for everybody else. Like, that was at least sustainable.
Yeah.
But like, once we were all on Napster and none of us paid the money, it wasn't viable anymore.
But why do you think it is? Like, okay, so at the time, I remember thinking, I was like, hey, music industry, hey, movie industry, if you don't want me to pirate, you got to come up with something better. Right. You got to come up with something better than piracy. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that's the way that they beat it. And that's what they did. Right. Yep. Like, we ended up with streaming, and in movies and TV, we have Netflix. We have all these streamers. And like, you know, I still have a BitTorrent client, but I only use it when I cannot find something otherwise. Mm-hmm. Like, if I want to watch some BBC show from 1995, I go on BitTorrent. Right. Because it's probably not available anywhere else. And I have subscriptions to all these services now. The fucked up thing is that, like, in music, Apple and Spotify, we've got this story where all the people making the art are making almost no money from these services. That's like the rub of it, is that it looks like much worse for the industry. The industry shrunk. But in TV and movies, that's not the story, right? People aren't, I mean, like, Netflix has too much power, right? Disney has too much power, but we're not saying, oh man, like, the people who make, you know, movies can't make a living off of it anymore, right? Like, we're not saying that the industry hasn't shrunk in the same way that it has in music, even though we've moved to streaming in both of them. We went through that same piracy disruption, and then we moved to streaming. So what do you think is, why do you think that's happened more intensely in music? Or do you think I'm off base in my analysis?
Well, you know what? I think that's a great point. And when I'm thinking about it now, a few things pop into my head. One, movie and TV, the production of it is a lot more organized, and they got in front of a lot of it. You know what I mean? Like, the unions, like, they made, like, you weren't gonna put them in a position where you were paying less for production just because it was streaming versus being on air.
Yeah.
And in music, you have none of that. There's none of that. There's no protections against making sure that there's still a cost associated with the production of it. You know, none of that exists.
There's no union saying, hey, if Mike's going in the studio, I don't care where you're selling it. I don't care if it's for streaming or not. You got to pay him this or that. Here's the minimum. Here's scale.
There's none of that. Everybody works for whatever, you know, whatever they can get. And that's from the producers to the engineers to everybody else involved in the process, the people who do the art, like, there's no protections. So if people can pay less, they will. So that's one thing. Two, in streaming, there's a lot happening right now with the big corporations trying to outdo each other to make sure that they are, like, the number one platform. And because of that, I think a lot of them overspend on production. And I don't know if that's always going to be the case. You know, once if Disney Plus fails, or if Apple TV fails, is Netflix going to continue to spend $1 billion on production?
Nah,
I don't think so. You know, so I think at that point, then we might start to see a similar contraction, in that marketplace too.
No, I'm absolutely concerned about that. That, like, you know, you look at those companies and they're getting more and more like commodities, where they're just like, hey, let's just get as many hours as we can for as little money as possible. And, like, as long as it's good enough, as long as people don't cancel their subscription because they got enough reality shows to watch, as opposed to, like, the peak TV years, the HBO versus AMC years, when it was like, how much money can we fucking spend on this beautiful period thing?
You remember, how much money Netflix used to spend on its original shows, like House of Cards, like, when it, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, so different now. Like they, like they've obviously realized that that's not what's gonna tip the scales in their favor is how much money they spend on something, you know. So I think that might be evidence of what's to come.
What do you think's to come for the future of the music industry?
I don't know. It doesn't look good. Because the reason it doesn't look good is because like. Even the biggest acts, I think like there's this little aura of desperation around even what they're doing. Like,
wow.
the PR stunts are crazier than ever. There's still a lot of like public narrative, what's the word? Misdirection and shit going on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They're still trying to figure out, is it best to release the Beyonce album by surprise, or is it best to announce it 4 weeks out so we can do a whole piece? Like they're still trying to figure it out. That's what scares me. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like and that it's like, especially because big artists, there's a value now in appearing independent and appearing organic.
Yeah.
That bugs me too. Like, because all of those things, in addition to helping those artists stay successful, they suck all the oxygen around out of the room for people who are actually struggling.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It doesn't look great. There's a lot of money in it because people still love music. So people are paying for Spotify and people are paying for Apple Music. So as long as there's money in the system, it's going to survive and it's going to evolve. I just think that the pie, the piece of the pie for independent musicians, I don't see that getting any bigger anytime soon.
It's the disappearing middle class problem.
Yes, absolutely. It's absolutely.
Yeah.
But in music, it's the disappearing of every class except the big one.
Yeah. I mean, that's what really concerns me. Like, again, just talking about CDs, it's like, hey, you know, part of what made indie rock or just indie music like explode in the late 90s, early 2000s is like, yeah, the CD thing that you're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. That like you have these small bands that are like, Granddaddy. Do you remember Granddaddy?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Remember that band? Mm-hmm. And like, you know, not a huge band, but able to, you know, I assume make money for about a decade because, you know, selling CDs and stuff like that. And like, does that, I don't know, how much does that exist anymore? How much does that market exist? Like,
I think that it's like this. I remember when MySpace started, people thought MySpace was great because, oh, now the playing field's level because everybody's got a page on here. So if
anybody
you make
an upload.
Right. So if you make something and it's great, you have just as much chance of being heard as anybody else. Well, that's bullshit. Because the truth is this. If you came into the MySpace era having already been established in any kind of way, you had a leg up.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not like everybody starts from zero notoriety. You know, so if you come into it and once you announce you have a page and you put that on your email listserv or whatever, suddenly you have 20,000 friends. Then, you know, then that platform's working great for you. But if you were literally just starting, it wasn't. And I think that a similar thing is happening now, where what's going to happen for independent musicians is I think things are going to move into a little bit more of a boutique market. Where, you know, it might get to the point where for independent musicians, they might take their stuff off of streaming altogether and just make direct to consumer products. You know, vinyl or whatever way they want people to experience the stuff and sell it that way. But again, that only works if you're established already. That only works if you came into this having a fan base, because how do you build a fan base if your products aren't in the retail marketplace?
Right. Like you can sell if you said, hey, I'm only selling my shit on Bandcamp now and it's nowhere else. Well, you've got a fan base of however many thousands of people who want to buy. You sold out your pre-release of your record. Right. But like, how do you do that if you're 10 years ago?
Yes, I have. And that's the thing. I literally have no idea. Like what if I was just starting right now? You know what I would do? I would put a lot of energy into videos. because I would be trying to sell my aesthetic over social media.
Yeah.
Like that's an angle that wasn't available to us previously that you can take advantage of now. But like I said, that works if you're good at aesthetic, if you're good at the internet, that works great.
Yeah, here's my look and here's what I stand for.
Right.
And if you like me, you like this kind of lifestyle.
Yes.
And that whole thing.
Yes. Like that, yeah. That can work. But, you know, like that takes some acumen, you know, like that really, like that's not an easy thing to do. Like on paper, you know, that formula seems pretty apparent. But the actual execution of that is like, you know, there's giant firms who exist because that's a difficult thing to do when these people get hired as consultants, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I worry about the talented people who don't have resources.
Yeah.
In the near future, I worry about how it is that they're going to be able to release music that reaches people.
Also, the social media thing, like, that gives so much power, not just to Apple and Spotify, but to like the YouTube algorithm, right? Like, mm-hmm. I think about in comedy, I got started because my college sketch group made videos and they got big on YouTube and actually just on our website. Like, we were mm-hmm. just uploading MOV files before YouTube, right? And the videos weren't even that good. They were just like our very early sketch comedy brains doing weird shit and people liked them, right? But now, if you wanted to get your stuff seen on YouTube, like this, if we uploaded the same stuff now, we'd get 200 views, right?
Right.
We would have to play the YouTube channel game and say, okay, how do you be a successful YouTube channel? Well, you upload every single day and its videos are this type and you got to have this type of thumbnail and like mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
Yep.
And all those decisions that end up changing your art in a way that YouTube wants your art to be.
Exactly.
All those decisions benefit YouTube, not the art or necessarily the audience. And you have to be in the top 0.0001% of people who are good at that part of it
yeah.
before anybody even sees your comedy or music, I assume. And so,
yeah.
like, I don't know, like, I imagine like SoundCloud as like a thing, for instance. That's a whole world I barely understand. But mm-hmm. like, you know, I know for a while it's like, oh, people putting stuff up on SoundCloud. Oh, shit going viral.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you know, that world, I imagine, would have a similar problem.
Yeah. And SoundCloud used to be the organic space. And
yeah.
from my understanding now, it's not anymore. You know, because
yeah. I haven't heard about it in a while.
Yeah. I mean, the labels figured it out. You know, they put SoundCloud as a company in a position where, like, if you're not going to help us push what we're trying to push in some way or another, then we're going to stop you from operating because all of your stuff here is copyrighted. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have, let's see, we're getting close to the end here and I like to end on an optimistic note, not on the note of, I don't know how people who don't have resources are ever going to make it ever again. I mean, what did you do in those first couple years that brought you to where you are? And is there anything that, you know, you think a young musician listening might take away with them? Not to make you say, hey, kid, be just like me. But,
well, you know, one transferable thing that I do still believe in is paying it forward, because that helped me out, too. Like, there were artists who were more established than me that got on songs with me, who helped me talk to labels, who put me on tours opening for them. They didn't have to do any of that. But that's kind of part of how this thing works, is that you're looking for who's coming up and you kind of help them out. Because this, you know, this indie thing is really about a community of artists.
Yeah.
So like, that's one thing that I'm always trying to do. Like I said, I'm using my label in that way. It's just trying to figure out how to do it successfully in this new marketplace. But I think that as long as, you know, indie artists who are established still kind of have that understanding of it and are looking for ways to help bring other people up, then there is some hope for how we can figure this out going forward. You know, so I think it's about people like myself scanning the community and looking for, you know, free floating entities that could use the support and the context and really make it an effort to help bring them up.
Now, that was a wonderful positive note. That was a really, that was great. Thank you so much for being here, man.
Of course, man. Thank you. Thank you. It was always great to talk to you.
You too. And what's the name of the new album and where can people get it and how can they give you money so you can pay your goddamn rent? Because I'm sure people are going to want to do that after hearing this.
Well, it's called Anime, Trauma, and Divorce, and it's out. It's not out till October 16th. I'm not sure when this is going up. And, you know, the biggest way to support it is listening to the single. There's a couple singles out. If you search Open Mic Eagle on your streaming services, you can check out those. And we sold out of our pre-sale vinyl, but there's going to be a standard vinyl offering soon. But it's really just about enjoying the music right now. And if you like it, letting other people know about it.
Hell yeah. Thank you so much for being here, Mike.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much again to Open Mic Eagle for coming on the show. That is it for us this week on Factually. If you like this episode, please, please, please give us a rating or a review wherever you subscribe. It actually does help us out. I know it's hard to believe, but it really, really does. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the show, if you got some comments, if there's a topic you'd like to see me cover, send me an email at factually@adamconover.net. Always love to hear from you. I want to thank our producers, Dana Wickens and Sam Roudman, our engineers, Ryan Connor and Brett Morris, Andrew WK for our theme song. As always, you can find me online at adamconover.net or at adamconover, wherever you get your social media. And until next time, stay curious. Thanks for listening.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.